Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Our guest today is Errol Lewis. If you live in New York, you know Errol. He's the host of New York One's Inside City Hall and New York One's You Decide podcast. This week, we're going to talk about Errol's new podcast, which is called The Last Liberal, about the history of one of the most fascinating figures in American politics, Mario Cuomo. Errol and I have known each other a very long time, and I am looking forward to getting into some New York politics with him today. Thanks for coming on the show, Errol.
Thank you.
It's been a minute, but we have known each other for a long haul now, I would say. It's been a couple of decades now.
There's been a lot of punditry. That's true.
a lot of punditry under the bridge. So first off, I want to talk to you about one of the most fascinating characters in American politics in the modern era. And you are just out with a brand new podcast series on Mario Cuomo called The Last Liberal. And I want to talk to you about why you chose to do this. Folks who are maybe a little younger than us might not understand how much of a influence he had on the way the Democratic Party operates and how New York operated for a very long time. So tell us a little bit about the podcast and about Mario Cuomo.
Oh, sure. Look, this year, 2023, is the 40th anniversary of Mario Cuomo being sworn in and taking office as governor of New York. He then served for three terms. There are a couple of things that are distinctive and remarkable about him. First of all, three terms is pretty long for New York. More to the point, we call it the last liberal because he really represented values and a style that are almost unknown in politics now. And he came to the fore as a FDR New Deal, sort of Great Society, Lyndon Johnson liberal at a time when the country was shifting. This is really in the midst of the Reagan Revolution that was about to kick into high gear in 1994, with the Republicans taking control of the House, and he basically lost office in that wave. But for a moment, he sort of stood in the breach for liberals and offered one last really eloquent statement of values that were being challenged and in some ways discredited across the country. He really was like sort of the last liberal. And then also, Rick, this is somebody who only ran for office for the first time when he was 42 years old, had a bunch of kids, successful law practice, did not want to be president or governor from the time he was 5 years old by any means. He was the son of immigrants, and it's an entirely different style of eloquence, of strategy, of thinking about the public good. I thought it would be good for people to see it and maybe reflect a little bit as we go into the presidential election.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And look, he was a guy I didn't agree with ideologically, but as a speechwriter and a communicator, I was in awe of Mario Cuomo. He was a guy who understood the power of language, rhetoric, great speech making, great writing, and he became this very persuasive kind of figure among a lot of folks in the Democratic Party, even those who were to the right of him. You know, even a guy like Bill Clinton was influenced by the rhetorical style of Mario Cuomo.
Well, this is exactly right. I mean, this is before the internet age. This is before sound bites. This is before social media. This was somebody who learned rhetoric from the Catholic scholars that he trained under. And so he had a real gift for metaphor and for imagery, mm-hmm. and for the play of language and rhetoric in like sort of the formal and classical sense. And he deployed all of those skills. And he would joke about the fact that he wasn't ready for the TV age, that he was pretty good with words, but that he was nobody's idea. You know, he had a face like Yogi Berra, you know, he wasn't somebody.
Yeah, sort of a hangdog.
Not coiffed, you know, not blow dried. This was a guy who, and by the way, he was a guy who, on principle, he shined his own shoes. I mean, mm-hmm. he did not want anything about the glitz and glamour of modern politics. So much so, Rick, that after he left office, he, as far as I know, is the only one out of like 55 governors who never sat for a formal portrait to hang in the Hall of Governors in the state capitol. Just wouldn't do it. Thought it was self-indulgent. He just wouldn't do it, even when he was an ex-governor. So a different kind of a guy, and a very interesting one.
So he had three successful governor's races, and there was a period of time when a lot of Democrats in the country looked at Cuomo as a potential presidential candidate. Tell us a little bit about that sort of the Hamlet on the Hudson story that kind of defined the back end of his political operation or his political campaign.
Well, okay, let's set the stage. In 1984, as Ronald Reagan is running for re-election as president, the Reagan Revolution is in full swing. Conservatives like Rick Wilson have been winning race after race all over the country. And at the Democratic National Convention in 1984, out in California, Mario Cuomo gives one of the keynotes. And as we know, those keynote speeches are where you sort of preview what's coming, right? That's mm-hmm. where Ronald Reagan delivers a famous speech. That's where Barack Obama delivers a famous speech. When they're sort of on the wings, you know, they're kind of in the on-deck circle.
Right.
Mario Cuomo gets one of the best speeches ever delivered in American politics. And it's phenomenal. It's just amazing. He doesn't even stay for the aftermath, goes straight to the airport and flies back to Albany, New York. But it's an incredible speech, and it sort of puts him in the on-deck circle. And so then in 1988, people say, hey, is he going to think about running? And he doesn't run. And in 1992, they think about, hey, is he going to run? And he doesn't run. But it really comes down to the wire. Hamlet on the Hudson. It's late December 1991, the literal last mm-hmm. minute of the filing deadline to enter the New Hampshire primary. He has a plane, really two planes, idling on the tarmac at Albany Airport, one for the press, one for him. He has the $1,000 check, the filing fee all made up, and then he takes to the microphone and says, you know what, I'm not going to do it. We've got pressing issues here in the Capitol, and I swore to help New York, and that's what I'm going to do. He lets the cup pass.
It's one of those fascinating, like, woulda, coulda, shoulda moments. Just as I think a lot of people in the political press were watching that very closely and anticipating it, you know, without that decision, Bill Clinton would not have won in 92. I don't think Clinton would have beaten him in a primary in 92. And I don't think you would have had, weirdly, therefore you probably wouldn't have had the 1994 Republican takeover. It's a very strange counterfactual to wonder, like, just where history would have ended up if we were in a slightly different timeline.
I choose to believe that the conservative wave, if you want to call it the turning from the 60s and 70s, that sort of two-decade answer mm-hmm. to the liberal ascendance of the 60s and 70s, I think that was going to happen.
Probably.
Nobody other than Slick Willie, who could triangulate and charm people, plus enable assists from Ross Perot to drain off some of the Republican vote. I don't know if anybody could have done it, not even Mario Cuomo.
Believe me, as a young guy working for the then president, George Herbert Walker Bush, I very much remember Ross Perot and Bill Clinton and my nightmares of that era. We were talking a little bit about, you know, he was this guy, this enormously gifted rhetorical baseline, this persuasion that was sort of the centerpiece of a lot of his political work. The New York Republican Party has been evolving much like the rest of the National Republican Party. Like when I was there working for Giuliani, it was still a sort of Pataki-ish country club Republicans by and large. Talk to folks a little bit about how profoundly the GOP in New York has evolved since Cuomo's era, certainly, and since, you know, in the post Bloomberg, post Giuliani era, how radically it's altered.
Well, yeah, it has been migrating in the direction of the Republican Party generally. So the days of those country club Republicans, somebody like a George Pataki, frankly, who qualifies, you know, he's got the Yale degree to prove it, where they would pick certain issues. They were environmentalists, you know, they would serve miles and miles of Adirondack Forest and so forth. They were liberal on many issues. You know, everybody talks now about sanctuary city policy. The first person I ever heard talk about it was Mayor Rudy Giuliani.
That's right.
There was a way in which you could really always default back to the true ideology of New York politics, I would say, is competence in running a big, complex city and state. And as long as you did that, you know, we elected, you know, 20 years consecutive mayors, years of Republican mayors of New York City, two for Rudy Giuliani, three for Mike Bloomberg. And they did just fine in the pollings and everything else. But you had to be reasonable and you had to execute and you had to govern responsibly, meaning not try and force ideologies down the throats of voters who clearly wanted to go in a different direction. So, you know, with the notable exception of the death penalty, Republicans governed like centrist Democrats, mm-hmm. and Democrats like centrist Republicans, and things did start to take a turn as it became more polarized nationally, culminating, of course, with New Yorker Donald Trump. A lot of that really, they took it on the chin, the Republican Party in New York. They've got almost nothing going on. They haven't won a statewide election since 2002. So we're going on a generation now of kind of being out in the wilderness, so to speak. And that is a choice, you know, that's the flip side of the Republican ascendance elsewhere in the country, is that they made the brand toxic for middle of the road and independent New Yorkers and moderate Democrats. They look at that R and they just say, nope, not going to do it.
And as for statewide races, as you well know, about 65% of the vote is within about 75 miles of New York City. That brand of Republicanism that has risen up in the Trump era, I mean, it is without the Democrats failing on redistricting this last year or this last cycle, I think it would be a very different congressional map, because it's very hard to find enough communities in New York with that hard MAGA edge now to meet the MAGA elected officials where they are. You know, as somebody said to me the other day, it's like, get north of the New York metro area, and there are parts of the state that are very, very red. It's like ice cold Alabama, but it is difficult to achieve that without a lot of redistricting mojo up there.
They squeeze everything they could, you know, I mean, and both parties are guilty of this. They did the best they could with the maps that they had. But now I think I think we're in for a real change. I mean, they caught a couple of lucky breaks. I won't bore your listeners with it, but they caught some lucky breaks and some favorable rulings last year, and they squeezed out four seats that they, you know, two or three of them they kind of weren't entitled to, and one of them was George
right.
Santos. So they weren't really even able to fully capitalize on the lucky breaks that they got. They have some good candidates. Mike Lawler's a strong guy, you know, D'Esposito. These are talented young politicians. They're going to do the best they can. They've been trying to sort of migrate to some sort of a place where they can win these Biden districts. They're in for a world of hurt, though, if they can't find better district lines. And we're on the verge of a court decision that might throw the whole thing up in the air. And if they get really tough lines, that four-seat margin in the House that New York provided, it could shrink to 1, 2, or 0.
Well, speaking of George Santos, I mean, in the history of colorful characters coming out of the New York metro area, he has got to be right up there in the top 10.
Well, you know, the thing that is really singular, Rick, I wrote a column about this, is that unlike his predecessors, and, you know, on average since 2010, New York has had a member of Congress resign on average about every 24 months. So we're on a roll.
That's
here.
True.
Republicans and Democrats. Well, you know, we've had, you know, one guy who was like the tickling congressman who was living with five of his staffers in a townhouse, a married guy who got hit with harassment charges. He resigned. We had Anthony Weiner, who everybody knows about. We had Michael Grimm, a former FBI agent who committed felony tax evasion. We had Christopher Collins, who was caught on camera doing insider trading, and he resigned. The point is they all resigned. George Santos, you know, he would have just been number six. You know, it's about, you know, the clock was ticking. It was his turn. 24 months have gone by. And he decided to force an expulsion, which was, you know, frankly, you'll appreciate this. This was really, in some ways, a local decision. The local Republicans figured they'd have a better chance holding onto the seat in a special election than letting the Republicans, the regular cycle, roll around with Biden at the top of the ticket, because it was a Biden district. So I think they let their colleagues in D.C. know. It's like, yeah, look, locally, we want this guy out today, not next year. So there you have it.
Smart, though. That's very smart of them. You know, I don't think we've seen the last of him yet. He's going to become some sort of like you know, scammy, weird post-Republican influencer or something. Who knows?
You can get him to do a cameo for $200 if you want to do some gags for a Christmas present, Rick.
Listen, I don't know if my fiance would say this is a good gift. I think she might have objections to that one. So going back to Cuomo for a second, I had another note here. So he had two very prominent sons. Andrew, it looked like you were about to see a real dynastic kind of thing happen with him. Talk a little bit about where Andrew Cuomo is now and what he's planning on doing. And is you hear rumblings all the time about him coming back.
Well, he's not done yet. I can tell you that. I mean, I've talked with him personally. He's not done yet. He thinks there's a path back for him. I'm not so sure about that, but he's probing. There's been some good reporting about some mysterious poll going around asking if people would vote for Andrew Cuomo for New York City mayor. You can't confirm who's paying for the poll, but I'm sure he read those reports with great interest. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. He's been showing up in churches, you know, Black Protestant churches, which Catholic Andrew Cuomo doesn't necessarily go to looking for votes or redemption of some kind. So he's clearly intrigued and interested. I can also tell you, because I talk not only with him, but with some of the people around him, they're very frustrated by the current leadership. The migrant crisis, which is a global phenomenon, I haven't seen anybody anywhere in this who can claim that they've mastered it. But they think that he would have handled it very differently, and I guess I would have to agree. If you look at what he did during the pandemic, that is strong leadership. And we have a very different, more collaborative style now, which, you know, there are fewer bruised feelings, but there's also, you know, tens of thousands of migrants bottled up in New York City, and nobody else in the rest of the state will take them. And that's unthinkable in an Andrew Cuomo world. I mean, he would have called up all of those county executives and said, you can blame me if you want, but you're taking some migrants and they're coming tomorrow. You know, I mean, it would have been just that simple.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Eric Adams has covered himself in glory on the migrant crisis.
And, well, you know, he's the only one who stepped up. And, you know, as you know, in politics, sometimes there's a thin line between taking responsibility and taking blame. And so he took responsibility. Meanwhile, I can't point to any speech or press conference of Chuck Schumer talking about the migrant crisis. Right. And so the polls come out, and not surprisingly, Schumer's got great favorability ratings, and Adams not so much.
Look, Cuomo's name ID obviously is stratospheric. It's very high. Has there been enough breathing space from the scandals for him to run for office again, or is that or you think it's still too close?
Personally, I don't think so. And for two reasons. One is there are still some suits that are pending against him. There's some civil litigation still out there. And secondly, he has wanted to answer that civil litigation by really kind of putting pressure on some of his accusers. He wants to still vindicate himself and demonstrate that the charges, in his opinion, were baseless from the beginning. And so he's got a very aggressive, very good attorney named Rita Glavin, who is putting these ladies through their paces. I mean, you know, when it's time to come in for a deposition, they're getting hammered, you know? And so it's hard to move past it if the central figure, Andrew Cuomo, has not moved past it. So I think that's gonna be a challenge for him. I also think that if you're waiting to make the argument that, gee, New York's falling apart and you need me, well, New York's always falling apart, you know? I mean, if there's a day that ends in a Y, there's some crisis happening in New York. So I think that in itself is not necessarily going to make him a singular figure. There's always a crisis, and so it's only a question of who's going to help us muddle through. So, you know, we'll see. He's still looking for a path back. He's a cautious guy. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't do this lightly. And if he decides to step forward, it's only because they've really looked at the numbers up, down, and sideways and concluded that he's got a path to the top.
Yeah, I don't know him personally, but I always had that impression that he was very methodical and very much of a planner and a sort of goals and metrics, timeline, schedules kind of guy when it came to his own personal politics.
He wants to be drafted. I mean, that's the bottom line, is he wants to be drafted. He wants people to come and say, you know what? Let's let the past be the past. We need you now. We need your skills. We need an SOB to sort of put the state back in order. I'm just not sure people feel that way. That's the question on the table.
Yeah, that is it. I mean, there would be an argument you would say that he's the kind of candidate who runs and says, you know, I may be a son of a bitch, but I'll be your son of a bitch.
That literally was his appeal. Yes.
And it's funny because that was sort of the Rudy argument for a long time. While when he ran and when I helped Rudy's campaigns, that was certainly the center of it. Like, yeah, I'm the tough motherfucker. I'm going to take care of business. I'm going to do the work. I'm going to make all the trains run on time and keep the streets clean. I may be a terrible human being, but that's what I'm going to do. There is an appeal to that in the psychology of New York voters.
No question about it. I mean, but see, now the X factor is that we have our first woman governor, who was in lieutenant governor, right? And so we just got a little taste of it. I watched it. I moderated one of the debates between Kathy Hochul and Lee Zeldin. Mm-hmm. That tough guy approach, you know, you got to be very careful, especially in front of a TV camera, if you want to use that against a woman opponent. Mm-hmm. And Lee Zeldin, you know, he did about as good as you could do, and he came within 6 points, so good for him. But it's a very tricky business symbolically, because what she has said is that the era of fighting with my colleagues in government is over. Where, you know, you don't have to be a bully. You don't have to fight with people all the time. You know, on the other hand, you know, you have an evolving crisis, which a number of people have pointed out would never have happened if she'd been a little bit more confrontational with some of her opponents.
I keep my eye on Lee Zeldin. I think that guy's very ambitious.
Smart guy. He did what Republicans never do, which was he campaigned in New York City quite a lot.
Yep.
You know, the cards just didn't fall his way. And I think one important thing that he missed was he kept focusing on crime, which is a reliable vote getter for Republicans. But it turned out in the exit polls, people were actually more concerned about the economy. And he didn't really have much of a policy there. So, you know, a couple of tweaks, a little bit better, you know, a little bit better approach. And he could, in fact, I think, show Republicans a way to talk to New Yorkers that we're ready to hear at this point.
Yeah, I've kept my eye on him because I think he overperformed by a noticeable degree in a race where he should have been blown out.
Exactly right.
Speaking of New York, I love the city and I love its people, and I'm seeing a side of it right now that I hadn't seen a lot in the past, and that is this rising anti-Semitism you're seeing on the streets of New York, especially in the wake of the Hamas invasion or the Hamas attack on Israel and the subsequent war. How do you read that situation right now? Is this something? I mean, was it always latent, or were we just ignoring it? Has it always been out there? It's so disappointing on one level.
Right. Like a lot of people, Rick, I am shocked. I live in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. this is not a hypothetical question. You know, like,
correct.
You let this get out of control, and it can go back to 1991 when you literally have rioting in the streets. So I am shocked. Now, what I am seeing that I think we should all maybe try and gather a little bit more evidence, but I'm pretty confident about this. They're saying that on TikTok, Rick, there are like something like 54 pro-Palestinian and even pro-Hamas messages for every one pro-Israel one. Now, I'm thinking that whoever's running the algorithm back in Beijing or Wuhan or wherever it's coming from, mm-hmm. very easily just decide, let's just set the country against itself. Yeah. And let's do a little tweak in the algorithm, because these young people, it's so vehement, it's so quick, and it's happening in channels that you and I don't watch.
I'm 60 years old, Errol. I don't see any of that stuff, you know?
Right. I don't spend time on that. Right? No. Who's got time for that? But you know who does have time for it? Our kids and our grandkids,
yep.
right? So, mm-hmm. so, and they spend all their time on it. I mean, kids are spending more time on TikTok than all the other streaming platforms combined.
It's crazy.
And we don't know who truly owns and controls it. We don't know what the algorithm is doing, but if we in the United States had access to 1/3 of all the Chinese teenagers, it would be criminally irresponsible if we didn't start putting in a little messaging and tweaking algorithms to say, mm-hmm. you know what, dictatorship sucks, and maybe right. your society needs some change.
You need freedom, not oppression, or what have you, yeah.
And I think that is what is driving this. Now, the other side of me, you know, I got a whole shelf of books here, I'm sure you do too. We know anti-Semitism is millennia old, right? So
it is always with us.
How does it reproduce so quickly? And I'm thinking, I gotta blame social media a little bit.
There's nothing else in our society that spreads things like the blood libel. People aren't, they don't hear that in public. They don't see that in school. Their friends aren't talking about it. But the fact that it has suddenly been repurposed, packaged in a TikTok feed, it's just so striking how quickly that virus has spread.
And, you know, the older folks are going back to the old playbook where you would tamp down, you know, there'd be, you know, I don't know, some kind of anti-Semitic resolution being debated in the United Nations. And you would just summon everybody and you stand shoulder to shoulder and you condemn it. And then that's the end of it.
Right.
This is a different kind of an animal. It's trickier. It's more subtle. It's happening on platforms where us older, quote unquote, responsible people are unwelcome or unknown. So we have no juice. We have no clout. I am concerned. I don't have an answer. I think some of this has to be people just need a lot more information. Not a little bit, a lot. I've talked with local politicians who are out here calling for a ceasefire and so forth. And I said, you know, I haven't said very much about this. I've only been to Israel 3 times. I've been to the West Bank once. I was near the fence at Gaza. I don't feel like I know enough to be, you know, spouting off. And these are people who've never been there. And they're leading marches and they're talking trash and they're comparing the situation to Jim Crow. And I'm like, by the way, you don't know anything about that either.
Right.
You
know? Yeah. Let's not minimize our own bad history. Well, Errol, thank you so much for joining me today on The Enemies List. I really appreciate your time today. I will look you up next time I'm back in New York City. And if I don't talk to you before then, have a Merry Christmas. And we'll see you again soon.
Same to you, Rick. Thanks very much.
Thanks, man. Abortion is one of the most complex and terrible issues in American society. And as a former Republican, I was never a social conservative. I was never a God Squad guy. But I will say this. I always held in my mind the two sort of, what I thought was the American tension about it. Abortion is not a comfortable subject for anybody, but neither is an unlimited restriction set on abortion. And two American presidents caught it right in the sort of weird heart of the matter. George H.W. Bush, my old boss in the beginning of time, said, you know, I'm pro-life, but I believe in exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. America was there with him. Bill Clinton said abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, and America was there with him. And as much as people disliked Roe versus Wade as law, it had become part of the American fabric. Now, with the Dobbs decision, the Republican Party has taken tremendous damage over the years. And that damage politically is one thing. But what we're seeing now is that in red states, people like Ken Paxton and the Texas Supreme Court have given us what they really intend. And that is that they intend that women who have pregnancies that will result in either a child which will not survive or will result in the loss of their fertility or in the loss of their life can fuck off. I know this is a couple days late, but the Kate Cox case in Texas has been one I've really been thinking about a lot. And watching Ken Paxton, the corrupt criminal attorney general of Texas and the Texas Supreme Court tell a woman who has been diagnosed carrying a child with trisomy X that under Texas abortion laws, she cannot receive an abortion, tells you how deeply, deeply evil these men are. And look, folks, I'll tell you, I was never a God Squad guy, but I hold two tensions in my heart about abortion too. One is I believe that life is a sacred thing. The second part is I believe that people have their own moral judgments and their own moral imperatives. And the third thing is I think government should stay the fuck out of people's business. That's all on its head when it comes to the Texas Supreme Court and Ken Paxton in Texas. And they are deeply, deeply on the enemies list. Thanks again for listening to the enemies list. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy.
While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.